This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, April 19th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. A record-breaking number of women are running this year for Congress and for governor, 607 of them. Emily's List, a political action committee that funds pro-choice female candidates, has raised more money than in any previous midterm season since its founding in 1985. Alyssa Slotkin, a former analyst for the CIA who's competing for a congressional seat in rural Michigan and is supported by Emily's List, was asked in an interview recently whether Trump's election has spurred the wave of women candidates.
You know, I think it was part of it, but it was the overall tenor and tone. Just women feeling like, if not me, then who? And if not now, when?
The majority of these candidates are Democrats, but there's also been an increase of women on the Republican side. Representative Martha McSally of Arizona, a Republican running for a Senate seat, has been enthusiastically endorsed by Donald Trump.
I'm a fighter pilot, and I talk like one. That's why I told Washington Republicans to grow a pair of ovaries and get the job done.
Margaret Talbot joins me to discuss the sudden rise of women seeking public office and how the sexual scandals surrounding Trump are shaping the politics of the midterm elections. Margaret, welcome.
Hello.
I thought we'd start by going back to the Women's March on Washington, which came the day after Trump's inauguration. At the time, as I remember, there was a lot of speculation about whether that activist momentum could be sustained. But then I was thinking about that this morning. These numbers that we've just gone through and the range of ideology they represent seems like one of the most vivid bits of evidence we have that the momentum is there. And much of it, of course, is a backlash to Trump, but not all of it, as Martha McSally proves. What do you make of the fact that a number of conservative women have been mobilized as part of this wave?
Well, first of all, I would say, yes, I think this is the best evidence that the Women's March has galvanized political activism, and not just political activism, but running for office to an extraordinary degree. I would say overall, this is still a phenomenon largely driven by Democrats, by, you know, anti-Trump sentiment. And there is still, in fact, it's growing, a significant gender gap between Democrats and Republicans, and that's particularly striking among younger women. That is the overall picture. But within that, as you say, there has also been this mobilization of Republican women who are not running against Trump, and in fact, in many cases, are running with him or with his support or supporting him. And it creates some strange paradoxes, which we can talk about a little bit. But, you know, I think that this new awareness of sexual harassment and abuse of power does transcend party lines to some extent, because sexual harassment and abuse of power transcend party lines. And you see it in people like Barbara Comstock, who is a running for a second term in Congress from the 10th District in Virginia, which is a very vulnerable district, an increasingly liberal area, and she's a Republican. And although she is identified with Trump and has very high ratings from the NRA and so on, she has been talking a lot about sexual harassment and has used some pretty strong language, saying, you know, we got to get the trash out of Capitol Hill and that kind of thing. And in fact, called on Trump to step out of the race when the Access Hollywood tapes were made public. But somehow is also now very much allied with Trump. So it's to my mind, a pretty peculiar needle to be threading, but she is trying to thread it.
Democratic organizers of outsider candidates, they seem to be wary about being overly optimistic, not least because of the way the 2016 election turned out. And incumbents, of course, always have such an advantage in these races. But there have been some quite remarkable upsets. There was Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania's special election for a House seat, Doug Jones of Alabama in the Senate, and then the many diverse candidates elected in Virginia's races last year.
Yeah. People like Debbie Walsh at Rutgers, the Center for American Women in Politics, who follows these developments very closely, has been saying that, yes, you know, normally you try and be somewhat cautious and realistically temper enthusiasm and point out that it's very difficult for first-time candidates and for especially people who are not running for open seats to win. But actually, in the case of the Virginia legislature, there were kind of some astonishing wins against incumbents, and yes, by women and by a transgender woman, by various minority groups that had not been represented in the legislature before. So it's just one, you know, one election in one state legislature, but I think a lot of people regard it as a bit of a telling sign for this year.
There was a wave election in 1992, and that year was called the Year of the Woman. What happened then?
Well, that was interesting because there's some real parallels to what we're looking at now and to the issues that are animating people now, because that was right after the Clarence Thomas hearings and the Anita Hill story, and right after people, you know, witnessed that really stark demonstration of how few women there were in Congress and, you know, no women on the Judiciary Committee. I mean, clearly the frustration about that and about the fact that, you know, her claims did not prevent him from becoming Supreme Court Justice really, really motivated women to run for office and to vote for other women. And we're seeing, you know, another moment, which I think actually will be more than a moment. I think it's really more of a watershed or turning point. But this is also a moment, of course, of frustration that, in this case, actually we elected the president who had boasted of sexually harassing women.
Even within the Democratic Party, the candidates running in November represent a wide range of views. And you did this piece, which we just posted on the website, which is really interesting, about many, many of these women who are running. But just talking about the Democratic Party, I noticed you've got really the two wings of the party represented, one in Heidi Heitkamp, the incumbent in the North Dakota Senate race, who's running in a state that Trump won by a landslide. She's a favorite of the NRA and has broken with the party on some issues, including the appointment of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, on the other end, Tammy Baldwin, a gay liberal who's running for re-election in the Senate in Wisconsin. And she's got a very tough race, it sounds like. Does this just tell us about the way different candidates have to run in different parts of the country, or is there something more at work there?
I think it is about how different candidates have to run in different parts of the country, and that maybe this push to have the Democratic Party kind of come down on one side or the other as a sort of, you know, progressive Bernie Sanders alert to many different constituencies versus kind of a centrist, emphasize our ties to the white blue collar constituency, you know, that kind of pick one side or the other, pick one lane or the other is really a false choice, and that people have to, you know, people have to run differently in different parts of the country according to their constituencies and their local politics. And, you know, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin has been quite a successful fundraiser and campaigner. There's a lot of money, outside money, pouring in to the state to defeat her. I think because Republicans have had so much success in Wisconsin at other levels of government, there's sort of this desire to turn the state completely Republican, and she's kind of, you know, what's standing in the way of that.
Well, and in Wisconsin, there's an anti-Trump backlash underway, too. You see it with first of all, you see Paul Ryan stepping down from the House, and then some of these Democratic upsurge in the labor movement and other places where they've been rebelling against very conservative leadership there.
Right. But, you know, a lot of the excitement, I think, is not just about the number of women running. There are, for example, more women of color running than ever in the past. And you have people like Stacey Abrams, who's running for governor of Georgia, who would be the first black female governor in history. So, you know, kind of a sense of breaking old boundaries and, you know, bringing people into politics who had voices before in the same way. And so there's a lot of excitement about that, I think.
At the same time, do you think there's a danger in pursuing identity politics too much? So I was thinking about this. I was listening to David Axelrod's interview of Stephanie Schock, who runs Emily's List, and, you know, some of the lessons learned about Hillary Clinton's failed campaign. And Schock said that she's worried that Democrats will again alienate voters by reaching out to niche groups. I think Axelrod called it demographic roulette. And she was advocating the party uniting under a big, simple economic platform.
Yeah. I always feel like when these issues are talked about as niche or boutique or identity that, you know, they're ignoring the fact that, for example, reproductive rights issues for women are also economic issues. And so I think there are ways that you can, and perhaps, you know, it hasn't always been done effectively in the past, but that you can tie together the idea of civil rights, recognition of diversity, with a sense of fairness and economic progress. And I'm sure, obviously, it's going to differ from part of the country to part of the country, and you're going to have to emphasize certain issues more and perhaps tamp others down in certain parts of the country. But I don't think you can jettison those. And I think, as I say, a lot of the energy in the future of the party is with diversity and millennials if they come out and vote.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You know, one of the interesting aspects of this field of women, and you touched on it in your piece, is how many of them have experience in the military or in national security. That's in both parties.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I had not been aware of that before working on this story. And you have, I think, an unprecedented number of women veterans running. And some are like, you know, Martha McSally, who we were talking about, the Arizona congresswoman who's running for Senate in Arizona, who says things like, she was asked by an AP reporter, because she often sings the national anthem. She has a lovely voice. She sings the national anthem at public events, and an AP reporter asked her if she was a trained singer, and she said, no, I'm a trained killer. So she has this kind of swagger, and she's, you know, very much identified with Trump. And so you have her, and then you have Democrats like Mikey Sherrill, who's running in New Jersey for Congress, who was a former Navy helicopter pilot and also a former federal prosecutor. And there's another Democrat, Amy McGrath, running for Congress in Kentucky, who was a Marine Corps pilot. And then there's Pam Keith, who's an African-American Navy veteran, running for Congress in Florida. There are more, but those are just some. I think for Democrats, it's probably pretty helpful because, you know, to the extent that you can still ding Democrats or Democratic women for maybe not being schooled enough in national security or skilled enough or foreign policy or something, you know, these are women who clearly can counter that argument or prejudice and are, you know, very tough, accomplished people. So I think it can be quite, you know, obviously quite impressive resume for some of the women running.
Suburban white women have responded negatively to the revelations about Trump's alleged affairs and his attempts to silence these women. Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, announced yesterday that he may file a defamation suit against the president. And Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, is already under investigation. So how big a problem do you think this could be, or is it just impossible to tell at this point? You talked about the gender gap a few moments ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a pretty hard one to predict. It's hard to underestimate, you know, the willingness to put on partisan blinders in these cases, even though I think Me Too is going to have a lasting impact and people all around the political spectrum are thinking differently about what it means to deal with sexual harassment on the job and to have to bring forward these kind of allegations. At the same time, you know, you think about at the State of the Union address, you know, when the Democratic congresswomen all wore black in support of Me Too and victims of sexual assault, and I don't think any of the Republican women joined them in that symbolic gesture. And we've seen, you know, in all kinds of ways, it's not just women, obviously, and not just this issue, how Republicans are able to ignore some of their own core beliefs in order to not alienate the Trump base. So I'm not super optimistic that, you know, hardcore Trump supporters, even women, will be that affected by the Stormy Daniels allegations. And if you look at, you know, the Democratic history with Bill Clinton, it's a similar phenomenon. So I think it'll depend a little bit on, you know, who else comes forward, you know, and it'll just become such a drumbeat that it becomes hard for people to ignore. If it's just this story, I'm not so sure.
And, you know, we've all become a little bit skittish about taking polls too seriously in advance. But in January, a Gallup poll showed that women have been more critical than men of Trump's performance as president, about his personality and his policies, and they've given him lower approval rating throughout his presidency. So one can only assume that that sense of disapproval will grow if these scandals do not go away, and they don't show any likelihood of going away.
Yes, sure. And particularly for, you know, independent women or women who held their noses when they voted for Trump the last time around, there's going to be some room for feeling more alienated from Trump.
I wanted to run this passage by you that I came across this morning in Hillary Clinton's memoir, What Happened. She wrote, "It's not easy to be a woman in politics. That's an understatement. It can be excruciating, humiliating. The moment a woman steps forward and says, 'I'm running for office,' it begins. The analysis of her face, her body, her voice, her demeanor, the diminishment of her stature, her ideas, her accomplishments, her integrity, it can be unbelievably cruel." Any sign of it getting any less cruel?
I do think there is some change, and partly it's in numbers. I mean, there is solidarity and confidence that comes when you get this many more women running and this much of a sense of it being kind of a movement and a reckoning and having that kind of energy behind it. So I think that actually does help. And also, I think there's a lot more training of female candidates going on now. A lot of it, you know, came about since Trump and in the last couple of years. That will be helpful. And there is more of a little of a sense of, you know, I'm running as a woman and I'm not trying to pretend I'm gender neutral. My strength is that I'm running as a woman, you know, and I mentioned in the article that there are a couple of women who are running for governor in Maryland and in Wisconsin, I believe it is, who both have campaign ads where they're breastfeeding their babies while they're talking about policy issues. So there seems to be less feeling of, I have to pretend that I'm kind of above my gender or beyond my gender. And I think that is a really good thing.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you. It was fun.
Margaret Talbot is a staff writer. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.